birthday party?
Miracle. There you go. Welcome to the Abracadabra Podcast. I'm your host, stand-up comedy magician Danny Whitson. I hope my Abracadabrans are getting stuff done, son. Hit the grind. I know I am this weekend. Yes. I am actually part of the Secret City Festival concert going on here in my hometown, and which is tonight and tomorrow night. So my hands are very, very busy. Very, very busy. Tonight, we have a new country music artist of the year, Jimmy Allen, performing. Then tomorrow night, we've got the R&B hip-hop group All For One. We're a big deal in the 90s. And hey, I still like their music now. They'll be performing Saturday night. So I've been dealing with that all morning. All week, actually, if you want to know the truth, and I'll be dealing with that all weekend. But I'm still taking the time to get this awesome episode out to you guys. So before we kick things off, let's give a big shout out for the sponsors for today's episode. This episode is also brought to you by The Grove Barbershop. Now, guys, I've been getting my hair cut at The Grove for a long time, and owner and operator Jeff Hackler is an awesome barber. And the best part is, all you have to do is just make an appointment. You go online to thegrovebarbershop.com, select your time, select the day, and then show up. You show up, everything is clean, organized, and it's just you and Jeff. He gets your hair cut, gets you looking nice, and gets you out of there in no time. So be sure to check out The Grove Barbershop, located at 98 Randolph Road, Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Give Jeff a call if you want to at 865-482-2210 and make your appointment at thegrovebarbershop.com. Okay, today's guest is a stand-up comedian and magician. He is a very, very creative guy in the world of comedy magic, but also he's done some really cool things too. He's been in a Got Milk commercial, which you've probably have seen before. And I thought this was really cool. He's been on the Oprah Winfrey Show. Yeah. I mean, how many people can say that? You know, super cool. Very nice guy. Very funny guy. He also gives some great advice. Okay, so if you are a performer, almost I would say of any sorts, you could probably use this advice. Some things that I've never even thought of before. And I was like, I can't believe I've never thought of this. So... but absolutely very valuable advice that he gives on this episode. So if you will, Abracadamets, sit back and relax and enjoy my fun conversation with comedian, magician, Bruce Gold.
All right, I'm excited. I've got stand-up comedian and magician Bruce Gold here today on the Abracadam podcast. How you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I am talking to you from sunny Southern California, and so... no matter how stressed out your day may be, it's usually 74 degrees with a light ocean breeze. So it's all good.
Rough and the rough life, the rough life.
Yeah. Just don't talk about traffic.
Well, I tell you what, now, you know, magicians know who you are, comics know who you are, but do you mind to go ahead and introduce yourself to the Abracadam listeners?
Yeah. Hey, if you're not in the world of comedy or magic, you probably know that the comedy boom was really big years ago when every disco in the country kind of turned into a comedy club. And many of us performed beneath a mirror ball for many months and or years until people finally went full tilt with the comedy club thing. And I grew up in Palm Beach County, Florida. My initial introduction into show business was doing backyard birthday parties and things like that. And then I got a little older. I did corporate events. I studied theater in college in Palm Beach County Community College, one of the finest universities in the country. I think to qualify, you had to have a number two pencil to get in. But it was not a sleepaway college, so I have a less than picturesque college history than most of you, I'm sure. And then in theater, you know, I got interested in doing stand-up comedy. The comic strip Fort Lauderdale was about an hour away from where I lived. And cleverly, I would drive, and I went up on open mic nights, and I'd drive an hour down and an hour back every Tuesday to get up on open mic night. And I was good enough where they made me a regular, which meant that I got to drive down five nights a week for no money and go up at the end of the show. And the rule was, if you weren't there at the beginning of the show, don't expect to go up at the end of the show. I did comedy clubs around the country. I found very quickly that comedians at that time looked at magicians like, oh, you just buy your act at the magic store today? You know, and they, no respect at all, as Rodney Dangerfield would say. So I gave up the magic for a while and just did stand up, you know, and these guys who were doing stock lines were looking at me as a magician and, you know, criticizing me. So I'm like, okay, I'll take all the magic out. And I did for many years. And then when I worked my way up to headliner, I would put in this closing trick I did called the Amazing Psychic Toaster. And it's as, you know, offbeat as it sounds. I got interested in, you know, I was simultaneously pursuing acting, wanted to be on a sitcom, came out to California. Got very quickly hooked up with an agent, thank goodness. Did a stint at Caesars in Tahoe in a show called Masters of Illusion before they had the television show. And then coming into the home stretch now. And then got an agent out here in Los Angeles, started doing a little bit of television hosting and some acting in a pretty famous Got Milk commercial. And then got hooked up on cruise ships. And I was able to make in 1 week what I would make in 2 weeks at comedy clubs, which gave me if I worked 2 weeks on the ships, instead of being gone a month, I could be home for 2 weeks for auditions and things. And then, you know, pretty much along the way, several MacBooks and iPhone versions later, I'm in show business.
so much is covered in there. And also you did leave some things out also. Now in your bio, Bruce, it says you're related to Harry Houdini, is that correct?
Yes, it is a very distant relationship, but one of his cousins married one of my cousins many years ago, so it's not a blood relationship. But when you find out you are related to someone famous, however distantly, it can change your life. And I set out to become an escape artist myself. And one of my first attempts, I had my sister tie me to a lounge chair and push me into the swimming pool. And in less than 4 minutes, I was able to escape, only to discover my mother standing fully clothed in the pool next to me, assuming my sister was trying to kill me. And I had to explain that no, she was helping, and that this was all part of the trick. So thankfully, we didn't have to call the paramedics, and I escaped, but I was told I wasn't allowed to do anything dangerous like that. So I chose comedy magic. That way, if I die on stage, I can come back and do the show again the next night.
There you go. Well, okay. Now, I'm very similar to you. You know, I started out, you know, comedy clubs, MCing, stuff like that.
Right.
But now, what came first for you, Bruce? Did you get into magic as a kid, as a lot of magicians do? Was it magic first, then comedy?
Yeah, I think, you know, magic is an introduction into show business or socialization for so many people. I grew rather quickly. I'm just slightly over 6'3", and for a couple years, my knees were less than reliable. I was, you know, sprouting up like a weed, and sports was not my thing. But doing magic gave me an empowering way to relate to my peers, and that's a very common story. When I was in second grade, I had an appendicitis attack in the middle of class, and I was complaining my stomach hurt really bad, and they got me to the school nurse and then to the hospital, and they took my appendix out. And thankfully, fast enough on their part, they didn't say, go sit down. And an hour later, it would have burst. So I was fortunate. In the hospital, someone said, oh, what can we bring you? And I thought, well, this is a golden opportunity. I'm not going to pass this up. I said, a magic set. And right? some adult's going to bring me something I want. Okay. I'm sorry I had to be in a hospital, but yes, a magic set. And then I did what most people do. I opened a box expecting it to be filled with miracles. And instead I found instructions. And that was my first lesson, that magic's not a skill, not a power, it's a skill. So that's how it started for me. And then I'm going to guess, like yourself, you kind of got caught up in the whole fervor. I'm an older gentleman than yourself, I'm sure, but I got caught up in the whole fervor of, you know, the Steve Martin, Robin Williams, stand-up comedy, television specials. I fancied I had a sense of humor. I went out on open mic night, as I mentioned, to Comic Strip in Fort Lauderdale, found out the difference between what I thought was funny and what people actually laughed at.
Yeah.
And kind of continued from there.
You know, and I can so relate to you too, whenever, because whenever I, when I showed up to the club scene, I was the magician, you know, and I showed up and I was doing my tricks, and I was ignorant. I was naive to that, the way comics felt towards magicians showing up in the club, you know, with their, with their bot act, you know?
Yeah.
And there was times that I struggled. I was like, well, should I put the magic away and never do it? Should I just abandon magic? And there was a period of time to where I did no magic at all on stage. I just did stand up because I was learning stand up. And in my opinion, I think to give stand up comedy its respect, the only way to truly learn stand up is to just do stand up.
Yeah. Boy, that flight time is so important.
It is. Now, did you, so you said there was a period of time, though, to where that's all you did on stage was just stand up, correct?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like they expect you to make your bones, so to speak. You know, if you were a race car driver, you'd have to make a qualifying time. And if your dad bought you the car and you'd never raced before, they wouldn't have a lot of respect for you. So I started writing jokes, and that's so funny. I was going to show you my wallet, but I don't have pants on, because who does a Zoom with pants on? That's ridiculous. Anyway, but I have a little notepad that goes in my wallet with a tiny pen. And, you know, for many years, I would just, every time I thought of something funny, I'd jot it down. And because I was a regular at the comedy club, I got to get up and try the ideas and develop an act. And that stage time, had I been in a bigger city where there was many more comedians, I would have been fighting for stage time. I would not have developed as quickly. So it was a blessing that I started in basically a small market of Fort Lauderdale. And this was, you know, goes back, you know, a few decades. So now comics, you know, used to be, well, okay, I'm jumping ahead, but now comics have a much harder time getting stage time, especially here in Los Angeles. And you used to be, what do you do? I'm a stand-up comedian. Yeah, but I mean, like, for a living, what's your job? And then it was, what do you do? I'm a stand-up comedian. Oh, where do you perform? Oh, at the Comic Strip. What do you do? I'm a stand-up comedian. Oh, really? Can you get me a set at the Comic Strip? You know, so everybody became a comedian themselves, you know, and out here all the actors are, you know, trying it to impress the casting directors and get seen. So, yeah.
Well, you know, I finally... you know, once I felt like I, you know, I had a nice, you know, I had some good time under my belt, some good material, you know, that I was comfortable with. I picked back up the magic. And now my show now, Bruce, is a combination of both. I do
right.
A combo of stand up and magic. But that was a challenge on its own, too, is making sure. Those two work in a show.
I think as you discovered when you did stand up comedian, there's that rule of thumb that, you know, you got to get a laugh every 15 seconds. And magic, even the funniest magic, generally isn't imbued with that kind of velocity where, you know, it's so plot driven magic. So the challenge as a comedic magician or a comedy magician is to imbue what you're doing with the same kind of velocity that you have in stand up comedy. And a trick I did for many years was called the Amazing Psychic Toaster. And I tried to imbue that with a lot of humor so that there was a laugh every 15 seconds. And then by the time I got to the end of the trick, they almost didn't care if the trick worked because the ride was enough fun. There were enough twists and turns and laughs. And then the fact that it was an actual magic trick at the end that worked was kind of a bonus. But it's that... it's having that laugh per minute thing, you know?
Well, you know, also I want to add, because I am familiar with the torture routine, a hell of a trick. I love the routine. it's great. And you don't see nobody doing magic with toast today anyways. I mean, it's its own original thing, and I love it. And It's also strong magic. You know, that's the other thing that I love, because I didn't want to be the comedy magician who craps on the magic, you know?
Yeah.
So it's one of those, that's that thing I love about that routine, is that the comedy's there, boom, 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 you're laughing, and then bam, at the end, there's the strong magic effect. I love that effect.
Yeah, I think that magicians generally over the years developed a reputation of being kind of imperious, you know, like, I am the great this or the amazing that. And so the sensibility of people was like, oh yeah, really? And it became kind of adversarial. And I think as a comedy magician, you remove that by being a little vulnerable. And my thing is that I'm comedically self-aggrandizing in a way that I get to shoot myself down when things don't work. And then that allows people to see that I'm not trying to be superior. So that's a classic comedy technique, you know, not magician in trouble, magicians call it, but to the audience, it shows vulnerability that, you know, it's almost like the juggler who drops one and then picks it up and tries again and drops. And then on the third time he gets it, and it builds up the tension and the impossibility of it. And so, yeah, I try not to, be so me focused in my act.
I'm with you. I do the same thing, because, you know, as well, is especially a long ways in humor, if your audience can relate to you, they're going to laugh more anyways, if they can relate to the person you are. Yeah. And in magic, whenever we do screw something up, you know, there's, or, you know, we, you know, so it looks, the, you know, you could, sometimes you can tell the audience is on your side, and they're, you know, and if you, and then when you do pull out the miracle, it hits, you know, hits even harder. But I think that's kind of like, maybe, do you think to a certain extent in comedy magic, that's also maybe a form of the self-deprivation type of thing?
Well, I call my show now Laugh, Laugh, Wow, because it's so comedically based. And I'll give you a tip. This is for any of the performers, and it carries over to the other variety arts, but it's especially important in magic. In magic, it's all about creating tension and releasing it. A comedian does that with the setup of a joke, and a punchline is the release of tension. And there is a time when it doesn't serve you to be funny. And so I do in a routine with a gentleman who's on stage, and his money has vanished, and it's going to reappear in an impossible place. And it's based on a classic plot in magic. And leading right up to the revelation of his money being in this impossible place, many performers will do little jokes. And I have discovered through trial and error, that's why I talk about the flight time, the actual getting on stage and doing it, I've realized that it is it's releasing the tension with the humor right before the big climax. And so I stopped doing the jokes right before the climax of the trick, and I slowed down, and I really focused on the moment, and I let people be there in the moment, and I let the tension build. So when they saw this borrowed object in an impossible place, it went from getting applause to getting this pre-applause moment where people go, no, get out, no way, nah-uh, as I heard from a woman from Alabama last week. She was so funny. Her running thing through the show is every time I did a trick, it was nah-uh, right before the climax. And that's how you know that your tricks are powerful, because if the audience understands so clearly what must be about to happen, and at the same moment is struck by the impossibility of that very thing happening, they almost involuntarily go, no, or no way. And so I call it the no way moment. And when I work with people and coach them, you know, we break the show down into its pieces. And then like a puzzle, we put it back together to make the best possible picture. And I always say, you know, when you're doing the magic, search for the no way moment. How do you deliver that climax the most powerful way?
I totally agree with that. I think that is perfect. You know, now, because it's really easy as a comic, and you know this, how easy it is as a comic, how uncomfortable we get with silence. And it's sometimes, just like you said, silence is a tension builder. And also silence is some of the best response you could get from a magic trick. You know?
Yeah, I like to say my theory of performing is that an audience is only ever in two states. They're either actively engaged and connected to the performer in the proceedings, or they're disconnected and waiting. And the trick is to never make them wait. And the exception is suspense. Suspense is active. They are actively anticipating and trying to figure out what is happening or about to happen. And that's not waiting. But one of the things I will say to people is take your phone or your camera or whatever, if you're recording your shows, and turn it around and record the audience. And then when you watch that back, you'll see when do they lean in, when do they appear distracted, when, God forbid, do they check the universe of possibilities they carry in their hand. You know, if they're texting during your show, maybe they got a babysitter with a sick kid at home and they're worried, or maybe you're just not being engaging enough. So my thing about it, and I say an act is always a constant process of refinement. It's never set. You're always trying to engage more fully, get bigger reactions. And so my thing is all about engagement and to look for the moments of engagement. I'll give you an example. I used to do a thing where two objects that were linked together unlinked. And I used to say, I just need the right magic words. And if it was, say, a corporate show for like I did, like for Novartis, I would say, I think the magic word has to be Novartis, blah, 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 or whatever their theme or event or product was, right? And one evening at the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, California, I said, I just need the right magic words. And a woman yelled out, abracadabra, and which was funny on its own. And so, you know, I let that moment get its laughter. And I had said in the setup to the moment, abracadabra, it didn't work. And then hocus pocus, and it didn't work. And then I said, I just need the right magic words. And that's what I normally would say, like Comedy and Magic anniversary show, which it happened to be. That was what I was planning to say. And this woman yelled abracadabra. And I said, well, you know, it didn't work when I did it. But I'll bet if we all say it together, ready, abra, and they said it. 175 people said abracadabra with me, and then the two linked objects unlinked. And I never forgot that, and that's how I do it from now on. I ask them, do y'all know any magic words? And then people say things that are often very funny, and then I get them all to say it. So that is massive engagement on the part of the audience, and those are the kinds of things I continually look for. It's like you're pushing the button of attention on them. And I was just working last week with a gentleman, Kevin King, who's Nashville guy, tremendous magician and very skilled. And he said that his mentor told him years ago that tension equals attention. And nice. So that's a couple things for magicians and variety performers to consider.
Well, you know, that is something, first of all, that is great advice. I've heard record your set, record every show. But I've always heard record you. I have never heard before. I can't believe I've never thought of doing this, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I can't believe it's never dawned on me, yeah. But to record the audience.
That's right.
Gosh.
You'll get to see their posture, and you'll get to see when their attention is distracted and when they seem riveted on what you're doing and when they're smiling. You know, a lot of times if you're in a professional environment where there's any kind of stage lighting, it shutters down your iris. You can't really see beyond the first row or two in many spaces. And so you're not really aware of what they're doing. And so it was really a revelation for me. I was performing in the Palace of Mystery at Hollywood's Magic Castle. And it's multiple shows each evening. And if you do 7 days with three shows each evening, it's 21 shows. And that's a tremendous learning experience. And I was taping the weekend shows. And I said, I'm going to turn one of the cameras around on the audience. And what a revelation it was, because I couldn't see myself. So I couldn't be critical of myself. I couldn't, how did I look? How did I, what did I move? All I could hear was what I was saying, and I could see the audience responding, and it made me tighten some things up. So,
you know, like, of course, like, well, on the comedy side, you can hear them laughing, but this is where this is so important on the magic side, because we, you know, we're visual artists. So I cannot believe it's never dawned on me to record the audience to actually see what they're doing. See, you know.
Yeah, it's really helpful. Yeah.
The now you that's the other thing too. Now, is it just me? But when I do record myself, it takes me about a week or 2 weeks before I can get the courage up just to look at myself on camera sometimes.
You know what? I think that's actually beneficial. When I started out, I had that hour drive down and back, and I had a little mini recorder, and I would record the show and then play it back on the way home and hear things. And I discovered that some moments, they were truly spontaneous, and I couldn't make them happen again. It felt like shoehorning the audience into the moment. And so, you know, after you perform enough and you know your act well enough, you have a faculty where you can step out of your routine or your outline and address something that happens spontaneously. And people are hungry for authenticity. Oh, yeah. And they want to feel like the moment that they're experiencing is happening live, and that you are live, aware, and actively engaged in the moment-to-moment reality of the show. So when I have someone on stage and they do something genuinely funny or make a remark and I'm able to say something about it, it piques the attention of the audience because they know this person didn't rehearse. They don't have a script. And they, you know, all, I studied filmmaking as well. And all in filmmaking, a good filmmaker wants to put the audience in the state where they're constantly thinking, now what's going to happen? Holy crap, what happens next? Now what's the character going to do? And so it's trying to put the audience in the state of these harnessing these improvisational moments, because you've riveted everyone's attention because they're all wondering, all right, now what's he going to do? So,
you know, I had you talk about those spontaneous moments that I would love to figure out a way to make this happen every show, but there was a routine that I was doing, and basically I have someone think of their favorite 4-letter word. Well, I tell them, I'm like, keep it clean, keep it clean.
Yeah.
You know, well, it turns out the 4-letter word was at the end, you know, when I reveal, do the big reveal, and her word was soap. And she looks at me and says, you said keep it clean. And it just killed, you know, and I was like, this was brilliant. How I would love for this to happen every single show.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that, to me, I think that's real magic. Sometimes real magic actually happens, you know.
To me, the act is an outline meant to create those kinds of moments. Because, you know, it's like I have a saying, I've talked about it on my show that I do called Engage. I talk about, I'm trying to think, I had a little funny little axiom about it. Let me think for a moment. I'm working at a coffee deficit here. I was in
You're
a different
okay, time Bruce. Zone. So well, we know
I'm
Bruce.
I'm just short of lucid, but anyway.
you just got in. You just came in from the House of Cards in Nashville.
Yeah.
So
what it was, the idea though is that when things go wrong, or when someone on stage doesn't follow along, the rule of thumb is never angry, always amused. Because if something goes wrong and the audience sees you telegraph your discontent, it creates the wrong kind of tension. But if you're cool with it, they'll be cool with it. I have a remote control music player that I use in my show, and it was not functioning. It was like one song off for some reason. And I'm like, okay. And this is the part where I step into the wing to look at my music player, which is one song off for some reason. And I could not ignore the obvious. So I had to go back. And I mean, years ago, I did a show at the Punchline in Atlanta when I was doing stand up, and there was a big name headliner. And instead of having like one show a night and two shows on weekends, Friday, Saturday, they had three shows Thursday, three shows Friday, three shows Saturday. So by the middle show on Saturday, I did a Punchline without doing a setup. And everyone stared at me. And I'm like, did I say the part where I go blah, 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 blah? And it, like in unison, they go, no. And I'm like, let me show you how that goes. And then I did it. And then I did the punchline. And they laughed at the me trying to make up for the mistake. So I couldn't ignore the reality of the situation. If I had just gone on, they would have been puzzled. Like, what the heck was that about? Right? So, but the idea is that when things go wrong, it's a silver lining because people's attention is never so riveted. And if you can manage to say something even slightly amusing, you get like extra bonus points.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. It humanizes you, you know?
Yes. And
so, I mean, there's been plenty of times where I've thought, I'm glad that's not the only, you know, I'm not the only one that's happened to. That I'm like, I didn't tell the setup to that joke, but I hear I am about to say the punch. So, mm-hmm. I mean, but the only thing you can do is just acknowledge it and, okay, well, I screwed that one up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, when you start out with like these little things. Sorry, I'm just making a little note here of something I can talk about. When you start out with these lines, you know, like one day this trick's going to go right and it won't be a trick, it'll be a miracle, or these little things that can save you when things go horribly wrong. And they do go horribly wrong from time to time.
Absolutely. So. Well, okay, so let me ask you this. Okay, so you got your work in comedy there at the, in, you said Fort Lauderdale, was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now, but now you're out West now. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because now you've done a lot of interesting things, Bruce. Okay. So you're pretty much a regular there at the Magic Castle, correct? In Hollywood. But not just that. Okay. You have been on the Oprah Winfrey Show, correct? Oprah Winfrey Show.
Yeah, years ago, I had a friend who was a producer on the show, and she knew me as a stand-up comedian from a cruise ship. And she said, we're going to have an Oscar preview show. Do you want to come on and give some comedic picks and opinions about the Oscars? And so I did that. And this was the year that The Piano, I think, was one of the movies. And one of the characters in this movie was a young girl who doesn't speak. And the critics were like, oh, she emoted so well without being able to use any verbiage at all. And I actually was friends with the guy who played Thing in the Addams Family, which came out the same year. And my joke was about, you know what, if we nominate her, we got to nominate the guy who played Thing in the Addams Family, because not only didn't he speak, he didn't use his whole body. He only used one hand. So, you know, so I got to be on Oprah. And let me tell you something about Oprah. This is part of her genius. When Oprah talks to you, you feel like you are the most important person in the universe, because she is completely focused on you. And when I was leaving, there was a small circle of like four people around her. And I said, thanks so much for having me on the show, Oprah. And she stopped and she turned to me and said, no, Bruce, thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it. It was fun. And, you know, she could have just said, oh, you're welcome. But no, that's part of her genius. When she speaks to someone, she gives them her full attention, and she's a good listener.
You know, that is so, I mean, I'm glad to hear that, because really whenever you did see Oprah on television, and it looks like she really did genuinely care what they were saying in these interviews.
Yeah, she has what they call being present. She's 100% present with you in that moment.
And that's something that even I try hard myself to work on improving and being a better listener. You know, try to shut off what I'm going to ask next, or what mm-hmm. I'm thinking of next in my brain.
Right.
And listen to what's going on right now. I work on that, but that's something I strive mm-hmm. to be better at, is a better listener.
Yeah. And it does take a lot of work, because as performers, we are naturally focused on ourselves. What do we say? What do we do? What secret stuff do we have to do to make the magic happen? How do we manage the people getting on and off and standing where we want them to and following the instruction and laying out the plot for the audience? So there's so much to be focused on that is all internal or about yourself. So it does take work to put your attention outside of yourself. And that's what I talk about when I say being engaged in the moment-to-moment reality of your show, which means if someone on stage is asked a question, you're not ready to say the next thing. You're listening to the answer that they give, knowing that it might steer you in a new and valuable direction. But yeah, that's that thing we keep coming back to is flight time and having that time on stage to get comfortable enough.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. Now, Oprah came later, but did the Big Milk commercial, when did that happen? And how did that happen? That's a great gig, man. That's an awesome.
Yeah. You can find it on YouTube if people want to check it out. It's, I don't know if you can drop it into the show, but this Got Milk campaign was kind of famous, and Goodby Silverstein was the advertising agency, and they hired a director named Kinka Usher, who had done a film called Mystery Men and in a lot of other TV commercials that were very funny. And so I came in for the audition, and every magician and any actor who'd ever picked up a deck of cards was at this audition. And so you have to make, as they say when you're an actor, you have to make strong choices. So you have the dialogue, you know the situation, but you have to imbue it with what you bring to it as the character. And I decided that this character would be it was originally written as a birthday party clown, but they were open to seeing magicians as well. So I decided that this character would be very self-aggrandizing and equally inept. And then the humor would come from him covering his ineptitude. So the first thing I did is, you know, I had my hair done perfectly like David Copperfield and, you know, kind of, you know, came on with a, you know, aren't I great attitude, and I shuffled the cards, you know, and I did one trick, and then I shuffled the cards, and then the cards, I squeezed the deck at the long ends, which made them spring, almost explode out of my hands and shower down around me as if I had just gotten nervous and done it unintentionally. And they saw this facade drop completely as I looked at the cards on the floor and then looked back up and then realized I had lost the moment. And then I went like this, and I did this grandiose magician gesture with my hands up like I had powers, and then I moved to the other thing. And they found that comedic juxtaposition between the guy who thinks he's great or acts like he's great and then fails completely, and you see the vulnerability and then jumps back into the character. So that's kind of how I got it. There were two callbacks for that commercial, and for those who don't know, when you audition, then they whittle it down and they have a callback. And then if they're still undecided, they whittle it down again. So it went from, you know, more than 100 people that they saw down to the last several. And there was some name talent in the room, because you have to wait in the waiting room with the other people waiting to audition. And that can mess with your mind a little bit, you know? So I just said, you know, I do what I came to do. And, So the funny part was the first time I went in for a Honda commercial, which actually my good friend Jonathan Levitt, who's a magician, ended up booking. But they were looking for a magician for a Honda commercial. And this guy came in a full-on tuxedo, tails, bow tie, white bow tie. And beside him were three cages with a rabbit in one and some doves in another. And then there was a girl, they were also auditioning assistants. And so she was in a short spangly dress. And like I said, I knew all the magicians in town and everybody in the room. And I'm looking over at this guy sitting there next to these cages. And I'm thinking, has he never done an audition before? Does he think he's gonna go in and do his whole act? And just at that moment, From his white vest, I see the head of a capuchin monkey peek out and look around the room, and he puts his hand on top of the monkey's head and pushes it back inside the vest. And I'm like, nah, he's got a monkey in his vest? And I so wanted to be in the room and see that audition, but you're not allowed to. You go in one at a time. But to me, I never forgot that. It's like, you know, the guy with the monkey in his vest.
You didn't know who that guy was? No clue at all? Just
no clue who he was. I'd never seen him in the local magic circles, but apparently he was working enough to have a bunny, some doves, and a trained monkey, I hope. Trained monkey.
Yeah, hope it, yeah. Man, that's so. But you went in with some acting experience, correct? I mean, did you go to acting school? Did you acting classes?
Yeah, I studied theater in college. In Florida, and I also, you know, did some plays and did some what they call legitimate acting or legitimate theater. Like what we do isn't legitimate.
Yeah.
And so I knew a little bit, and I'd studied here in California with a very great audition teacher named Margie Haber. And then I also studied film acting and television acting, which each one has a different style to it. And so I had a little bit of background in that, which helped me out. And I also had done some improv training with the Groundlings, which at the time was like every actor who came to Hollywood would spend some time at the Groundlings working on improv. And then it became bigger, 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 bigger. And now I think the Groundlings has 3 locations and a private free, like a building where just the school is. And But it helped me learn a lot about it. And I encourage anybody who has to stand up in front of people to do anything, whether it's a speech or comedy or a variety act, to take some improv and to learn about not shutting down the moment, but to say yes and taking the information and keep pushing it forward. So,
absolutely. Yeah. I agree. I've studied, improv a little bit. I'm not an improv guy, but I have studied that. I do a lot of sketch. And all those things. And even in magic and comedy, we act when we're on stage, you know, of course we do. But seeing that commercial, that Got Milk commercial, you could totally tell that you were polished and you knew what you were doing up there.
Yeah. The most fun for me of that commercial is, the Goodby Silverstein, which is a big advertising agency, let me choose the tricks for it. Nice. And so they didn't tell me what tricks to do. I created the tricks. And we filmed on film, not on video, which is less common today. And they shot enough. They could have made a 6-minute movie out of it. And they ended up doing 3 versions of the commercial, 2 different 30-second spots and a full minute spot. And it aired during Frasier and Seinfeld and the World Series. If you've not seen it and you want to look it up on YouTube, look up Got Milk Magician, and you'll see one from either G-Force Media or Bruce Gold, and that's the one I was in. I play the magician in a senior's home, and I pour the milk into the top hat and make it disappear, and then these octogenarians get up and try to beat the crap out of me for making their ready source of calcium vanish. But it was
the old man there. He's giving you.
Yeah, we shot it over 2 days, and there was a lady in the commercial, and her name is Martha, and I guess Martha was in her 80s. But she had a line, and the director, they film it in pieces, so it's not like a sitcom shoot where there are multiple cameras. You know, it was either 1 or 2 cameras. So this was when the cameras were on the expressions of the people watching, which is this little semicircle of elderly people. And Martha had this line, and I would do the thing, and then she wouldn't say it. She would get this very impish look on her face. And the director would go, okay, Martha, say your line, Martha. Anytime, Martha. And I guess she would just wait for it to get good to her. And then she goes, lock the door, which was her line. I made the milk vanish and lock the door. So, very funny to everybody there. It took 2 days to film that, not because she ran long, but because that was the schedule of it. And it was great. It was like, really less like being in a commercial and more like being in a short film. And you learn something every time.
Now, did you feel, were you surprised whenever you got it? Or, I mean, because you said there were some heavy hitters in there with you.
Yeah, there were some other name comics that I knew. But I think that, as I said before, I had an idea. I came into the room with an idea about what the character was. And they liked my take on the character. So you never know. Really, I mean, I've gone in for things that I read the description and I thought, I am not right for this. I know what they want. They want like a David Blaine guy or a street magician with an edgy look. And I'm not that. I know that my thing is being a little over the top because I can always pull it back. But I make strong choices in the character. And I went in and I did my thing and I ended up getting it. And even if you don't get it, it's a chance to be seen by a casting director who would notice your take on things and they would think to themselves, oh, okay, this guy has some pretty funny ideas or he's a good actor or whatever. Or you come back and then he'll remember you if you did a good job. So that's usually how that works.
Well, you know, for me, I just recently got a part in a movie that's going to be out on Prime here this winter, which I'm excited about. But that's kind of my, and I've done some very small little things in acting and just recently got with an agency out here. But anyways, that is something that, you know, I found that I do enjoy doing it. I do enjoy doing it. But it's also a little different because when you're up there with someone else, like unlike comedy and magic to where it's your world, mm-hmm. Now you're having to share space with someone else, you know, and it's kind of, I find that, I like the challenge in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a similarity there because when you're on stage with another actor, you have to be present for them and you don't want to be thinking ahead to what's my next line. You want to be in the moment to them and you want to give them your reaction. So their next move comes off your reaction and what they did. I did an episode of Full House. I played a wacky weatherman who took over for Danny Tanner.
Nice! And,
it's funny because people will from time to time say, were you ever on, you know? So, yeah, I did that. And part of it was they wanted the character to have a laugh like a hyena, like this really funny, weird laugh. And I happen to have a very loud laugh. Because as you may know from doing comedy, comedians tend to intellectualize a joke. And rather than laugh, they will go, funny. That's funny.
That's funny. Right? I do that.
So when something genuinely strikes you as funny, comics tend to laugh. And I do. If I'm in a movie theater with you and I laugh, people will turn around to see who laughed. So I did this really, I hope my neighbors don't hear that. I hope I don't peek out your system, but I went, something kind of like a, you know, which was this hyena-like laugh. And the first time I did it, the studio audience exploded with laughter in a way that actually disrupted the scene. And they had to do a second take so that they could have a safety for it if they, you know, wanted the other character to come in a little sooner.
God, what a super awesome. And you're so true. That's so right. A lot of times I may not laugh, but that doesn't mean it's not funny. It just means that's funny. But then when that one thing that does hit that something, you know, and yeah, you know, I think my laugh's a little annoying too. So, but yeah. this, I didn't know about the Full House gig. That's awesome. Now let's ask you this because as an entertainer, you have to be a hustler. You have to be a grinder. And I mean, Bruce, like I said, you've done a lot of cool stuff, man. Was this, I mean, through just the networking part, the grind, or you know how they say being at the right place at the right time?
Yeah. Well, it's funny how 10 years of work can make you lucky, right? So I went for 2 years and I drove back and forth an hour to Fort Lauderdale from where I lived in Palm Beach Gardens to go up for no money. I put the time in And then I drove to Punchline in Atlanta and auditioned, and they had a few other clubs they were booking. And that's kind of how I got going. And then I was very diligent back before, you know, the internet was so ubiquitous. Anywhere I was going to be, it's like I booked a club in Jacksonville, Florida, and then I would send postcards with my photo to every club within a 4-hour drive of that club and say, hey, I'm doing this club on this date. You know, I could be, and so I set up my own tour and, you know, things like that. So you do have to be proactive, but I'll tell you the only secret to making it in the business, and this was told to me, the only secret to making it in showbiz is to stay in showbiz. Because every day you stay in it, somebody else gave up and you get better. So never, it's a constant process of refinement. Never get better at being you and doing what you do. And that's something I said last time I did the Magic Castle, which was, I'm going to be doing it at the end of September, and I'm so delighted because it's been almost 2 years since I've been there, and I'll be in the Palace of Mystery. And last time I was there, I got paid a very nice compliment by a fellow performer. He goes, you know, I've seen you before, but there's just something about you now. It's like you're just knocking it out of the park. And forgive me for the humble brag, but I said to him, I said, you know what I think it is? I just feel like I can be more like myself than ever before. And that level of comfort came from years of performing there. And I said, I'm more like myself than I've ever been. And I think that's the secret. Somebody, actor Tony DiGiorgio, who is an actor who you may know only from a very pivotal scene in the Godfather movie. Bruno Tattaglia, I think, was the character who was there at the bar, and he was the bartender. And at one point, he takes the knife and stabs it through the guy's hand in the bar. Well, that actor is Tony, and he did a lot of episodic television work years previous, in addition to being a great magician and a great card worker, and he's passed on now. But he had a kind of a gruff voice. You know, it was easy to believe he knew nefarious people. He, you know, was not, didn't orbit that world, but it seemed like he did, you know. And he had a great strength in his face, and his way of performing was almost, you could be a little frightened of him at times, and then he would smile. But he said something to me after the show I never forgotten. He goes, let me give you a little piece of advice. Trust that you're enough. And I thought about that for the rest of the performances. Trust that you're enough. And for everybody, you squeeze something different out of that advice. And for me, it was like, trust yourself and what you bring to the table or bring to the stage enough to be yourself. Because when we start in the business, we emulate those whom we admire. And at some point, you have to cross that threshold and discover yourself. You know, people say, you know, just be yourself, but you have to discover yourself. And you do that by trying on different things from people you admire. So I think that note was and is very formative for me. And they tell you all the time, you're the only you in the world. What do you bring that no one else can? How can you be honest to yourself? What's authentic about you? And Danny, I don't know if you've worked this into your show per se, but there's probably moments in your show where you kind of reveal who you are and what makes Danny who Danny is, that no other magician would do it quite like you do. So.
Gosh, you know what, Bruce? I got to be honest with you, man. You're giving away some good. This is fantastic advice, guys. If you're listening, Bruce has gave some really good things out here. Really good stuff. Well, let's do this. I've got to ask you this because, like I said, you have done so many cool things. Really, you have. I know you have to have one of these. So every entertainer that comes on to the Abracadam podcast has to tell a hell gig story. Let's hear one, Bruce.
Just one? Well, hey, let me plug a couple things and then I'll do that because I don't want to forget. You mentioned that, you know, I was sharing some wisdom, or as my friend would say, dropping some knowledge on you.
Yeah.
So I have, during, you know, the earlier months of the pandemic, I created a Facebook show so I would have something to do that would get me out of my bathrobe. And it's called Engage, Pro Tips for Performers and Presenters. And when you search for it, don't put the word "and" in, put like the little ampersand symbol in there. It's Pro Tips for Performers and Presenters on Facebook. And it's really, I started to make it for speakers and performers, and it ended up being mostly about being a performer. And there's multiple episodes. In the later episodes, I got more equipment and it looked prettier, but I also got other people from the business whom I interviewed. I can rattle off the names of the magicians who've been on, and all the magicians will know them, but just go and check that out. It's completely free, and you'll hear a lot of knowledge from my years of performing that I had to figure out a way to impart. And then I started getting asked to coach people. And so I started coaching people. Let me see if I have the thing here. I usually have like a little notebook that I made for my clients that I could show you the logo, but it's called Engage is the name of it. And I privately coach speakers, variety performers, and magicians. And I have such a varied background that I'm able to give viewpoints and information. Like if you came to me, Danny, and you said, can you take a look at this routine from my show? And I did, and I pointed out something that I didn't think was working. I will never give a note unless I have a solution. And I always give the note. So I always have a solution, and I write off the cuff, and I help you see what you can't see because you're in it. You can't see it from the perspective of the audience. It's like trying to be in the movie and behind the camera at the same time. That's why it's difficult to direct themselves, actors say. So I have that point of view because you know everything you went through to get to that point in your act. Maybe you tried 15 versions of it and you are married to these little moments you think you want so much to work that aren't. But all I see is what's visible, and that's what gives me a very keen viewpoint. So people have said some very flattering things about my services, and you can probably find that on the same page. So those are the two things I wanted to tell you about. The other one more thing is The Bruce Gold Show. I did 22 episodes of a talk show that was like a low budget Johnny Carson show. And I interviewed writers, authors, magicians, singers, and two guests a show usually. And I had a lot of great magicians on the show. So you can find that on Facebook, The Bruce Gold Show. And I think there's a few episodes up, but I'm going to put up like 12 episodes, and they're half hour episodes. And this went out on cable television, so it's produced like a real TV show. All right.
Fantastic.
Was that enough of a plug, Danny?
First of all, I don't care how long you've been performing, how long you've been at it. It is so valuable to have another set of eyes look at your routines. And, you know, yes, there's several things that I have tried that, you know, when I have had someone, another set of eyes, give me their opinion, why don't you try this? I think that would be super valuable coming from you, Bruce, especially somebody that has, you know, been in the game as long as you have and you know, has done the things.
I'm flattered that my first clients were other magicians who knew me from the Magic Castle. And then the word of mouth grew, and I ended up coaching a guy in Italy and Switzerland and Germany and Canada and a bunch of people in the United States. And somebody paid me a great compliment, which I think is probably the biggest value, is they go, we did two sessions. I do it all on Zoom. And we did two sessions. And he goes, I think you saved me 5 years. So,
oh, man, and I totally understand that too. I totally understand that, you know, because just like, you know, a joke, a trick, or whatever it is you're doing, it should always be evolving anyways.
It's a constant process of refinement. I did a trick that I did for 30 years with coat hangers. And I did a show. It was on board Norwegian Caribbean Lines. It was created by a magician named Jeff Hobson. All of the magicians know who that is. If you don't, and you've ever seen The Illusionists on tour, Jeff was in the first national and worldwide tour of The Illusionists. And he is screamingly funny and a brilliant, brilliant magician. And when he was on board for 6 months in the lead role in this ensemble magic show that had a theatrical storyline. So because I was an actor and a magician, I auditioned for it and I got the job to take over for him. I did his character in the show with kind of my own take. And I did my act rather than his act, because he's one of a kind and he can be imitated, but never duplicated. And so I was on that for six months doing that. And I did the trick in the to audition to do it in the show. And they said, I'm sorry, we don't have time. It's 4 minutes and you got to cut. It's got to be 2 minutes. And I started protesting and about how funny it would be. And I've done it for years and it's 4 minutes and it'll work in front of an audience. And they said, it's 2 minutes or it's out. And so when I finally got over my resistance and embraced the challenge that was set before me, I first I was like, well, this is, I can't just cut a verse out like a song. You know, I mean, there's a series sequence of things that has to happen to get to the end of the magic. And so I let go of that. I accepted the challenge. And then I realized there was a part in the middle where I could skip ahead. I cut out 2 minutes. And because less remained, I was forced to focus on what remained and focus on it intently. And I was able to make every moment more powerful because I re-examined it. And, oh, this would work better if I did this moment up in front of my face instead of down at my chest level. And this move would work much better if instead of doing it quickly, I did it very slowly. I had show after show. I was on board for 6 months. I had show after show after show to perfect it. And so what it taught me was, and by the way, I've never gone back to the longer version because I actually get more laughter and more astonishment in 2 minutes than I was getting in four. So I've never gone back to the other version. And it was a very important lesson for me in don't assume anything's written in stone. And being uncomfortable is sometimes a very good thing. Like so many performers, Danny, I don't know if this happened for you. I don't know how much you did online, but I didn't perform live for the longest time. And then when I came back to it, it was fresher somehow. And I didn't say things the way I always said them. I knew what I wanted to say, but I hadn't just said it six times the week before. So I was able to try new things out. So it's a bonus. Okay, we'll get to the worst gig in a moment. Okay.
I think that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing to be able to, you know, you were put in that situation and you turn around and pull the diamond out of it, you know, something that's great. And it's also, it's interesting to what you can come up with whenever you're put in that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like they say nothing motivates like a deadline. So many times when I was adding something new to the act, it was only because I was booked at the castle. And if I didn't get it ready and by that deadline, you know, but without that deadline, I might never have finished it. Because as you may have heard, Danny, some people in show business have a perfectionist tendency and they will put off doing something until it's quote unquote perfect. Yeah. And it will never be perfect without, you know, getting it in front of people and finding the moments that make it perfect. You know, it's a fool's game to think you can get it perfect on paper.
Yeah, you're 100% correct. Well, yes, Bruce, I'll tell you what, let's hear this hell gig story. We got to hear it.
Okay. Well, there have been many, but I'll just tell you about one that has etched itself into my memory. I got a call from a buddy, and he recommended me to his corporate agent. And when we say corporate agent, this is an agent who books events for companies for any manner of events that they're going to have. And this was like a banquet. And so he said, hey, do good. And it could really mean a lot of work for you. Knock it out of the park. And I said, great. And I talked to the agent and, you know, and they were like, knock it out of the park. And I'm like, okay. And then I get there. And mind you, it's a good 2.5 hour drive from where I live. And I have arrived 4.5 hours prior to the show. because I'm going to be prepared for any eventuality. And I walk into the banquet room, and the first thing I notice is there is a dance floor. And any entertainer who performs at corporates will tell you we call that the dance floor of death. Because what that does is it puts this large expanse, like a moat, between you and the front row or between the people. And comedy is served by an intimate distance. So you want the people as close as possible. Now, get this. I also made very sure that the meeting planner who had gone to the agent to hire a performer, that the meeting planner had signed my contract rider and said that there would be no dance floor. So I get there and I'm like, oh my God. And the staff is still setting up some tables in the room around this gigantic dance floor. And I go, there's no dance floor. And I go, look at my contract right here. No dance floor. And they go, well, I'm sorry, but our contract says dance floor. I go, they don't have a DJ. They don't have a band, but they have a dance floor. I'm sorry, my contract says. So now I can't tell the event coordinator at the hotel to trust me because I'm not writing the check. So the meeting planner, now I've got to track her down. And I'm thinking this may have been a new thing for her because she was already, I think, 3 Chardonnays into her day, judging from how she reacted to me. And I'm trying to find her and I'm trying to call her. And I guess she's handling another meeting that's going on in the same hotel for the same client. And so finally she goes to the banquet room and her whole attitude was, what? And I'm like, do you have a DJ? And she's like, no. And I go, do you have a band or a singer? And she goes, no. And I go, well, you have a dance floor. And so I'm trying to save her ass because what do you think's going to happen when more than 100 people come into that room and there's a dance floor, but there's no DJ and no band, right? She's going to look bad. And I go, well, I've told the hotel that there's no dance floor, but somehow on their contract, it says dance floor. Can you please tell them to take it away? And she's like, fine. And she goes in and then she goes away, right? I think I had woken her from a nap because maybe she was experiencing the day following several glasses of Chardonnay. So that's why she was so irascible, I think. And I try to be the guy who shows up early so they don't have to worry about anything. Don't worry, I'll handle it. Hey, we're going to start a little late. Is that okay? Don't worry. I'm here for you. I'm not running to another gig. I am here for, right? I'm trying to. So they take the dance floor away. They put the tables where they belong. There's no signage. This was years before people had their own pull-up banners, which is your own little background advertising. There's no lights. There's a platform stage, but there's no lights. There's no lights in that section of the room. I always say, put me in the brightest part of the room. I don't require that people spend extra money on professional lighting because they get hit with a big expense for that kind of stuff. I just need a microphone and I need a sound system I can plug into. Well, they had a sound system, so no one knew there was going to be a show. There was no signage, no awareness. The guy who spoke had no idea there was going to be anything following him. Can you feel my pain yet, Danny? And the story isn't even over. So then to cap it off, they call me and they go, we need you to go on now, the meeting planner and her friend who is frantic about everything. We need you to go on now. I'm like, I'm an after dinner performer. I make people laugh. That's not good with steak in your mouth. That could be a Heimlich waiting to happen. And I go, well, we don't want people to leave. And I go, well, they won't leave. I mean, they know there's going to be a show. And then I find out they don't know there's going to be a show. No, it's not in a program. It's nowhere. It's not in an itinerary.
Oh, no.
There's no sign. So I go, okay, I'll be there in a moment because I was in the men's room at the time. And I purposely went outside and took a little walk and calmed down. And then I came back into the room and I said, forgive me, I'll be there in just a moment. And I came back into the room when the desserts were going out, because in my contract, it says I don't perform until the desserts have been set out. But I guess they, you know, for whatever reason, they thought people would, you know, take three bites of steak and leave. I got up, I did the show. I won't say that I would have made that evening my television special, but I did the job. But the sad part was that the meeting planner said that I was uncooperative, and because she completely ignored my contract writer. And so I did not get future work from that agency. But what a lesson about living in the moment instead of harping on the past it was for me. Because I try not to think about it except at moments like this, Danny, when I'm asked to say a horror story. And I hope my fellow performers were cringing as I said that they didn't stick to my contract writer.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, and I mean, you have thought about that. That's on them. That's not on you. You know, but absolutely, I could own, you know, the dance floors, that's the worst. Mm-hmm. And who doesn't tell them there's going to be a show?
Exactly. Why did you hire a performer and not tell anyone there would be a performer? I mean, I have, you know, thank goodness I have the gravitas that I can charge enough that I only have to take one show an evening. I'm not rushing anywhere. So I show up ridiculously early. I've helped to hang Pipe and Drape, which is the curtain that they put at the back of the platform makeshift stage that they create. And often that's the job of the hotel. And if someone calls in sick, maybe that's what happened that day. But I helped the meeting and event planner hang the Pipe and Drape at the back of the stage before my show.
And you know, the other thing also, I want to point this out, because it's not like you were being difficult to work with. You said, no. Put me in the brightest part of the room. You don't have to buy this expensive lighting. And the fact that you do not want that space between you and the audience is you're looking out for your audience. You're like, you guys want to have the best experience possible. Get close, yeah. You know? So, yeah.
I mean, I literally expected her to say, oh, thank you so much. We'll get rid of that dance floor. I don't know what I would have done when they realized there was no DJ or band and there was a dance floor, but that's not how she chose to see it. And believe me, despite my discontent, I was congenial. So
that's tough. That is tough when you walk into the, and that's one of the problems sometimes with those corporate gigs. There's a lot of crappy corporate gigs. There really is, you know.
I think every performer who's ever worked at an event like that, and I'm going to guess you too, Danny,
yes,
knows the horror of the podium. You've been there, right? You go to do a private event, and you tell them you need either a wireless lapel mic or a corded handheld mic in a stand, and you get there, and the only mic in the room is attached to a podium. So every variety performer has this hateful relationship with speaker podiums.
You know, I bring a stand with me everywhere I go just in case, because right. I have to use my hands, and I do have a lapel mic and stuff, but you know, but I've seen those podium mics too. I've been in those situations. I'm like, I feel like I'm, you know, giving a sermon right now or something. This is just, you know, weird. But yeah, the podium mics.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I'm going to perform something visual standing behind a 5-foot podium, right? You know,
Well, let's do this. Okay. Before we get out of here, I also ask every magician this question. Okay. This is a thought provoking question. And this is special just to my magic brothers and sisters. Okay. I don't ask just the stand ups. This is just for my magic brother and sisters. Okay. I find this very interesting question. Bruce Gold. If you were stranded on a desert island, you woke up, actually, let me do this. You woke up on a desert island and you saw 100 spears pointing at your throat by the indigenous people on that island. And you, Bruce, had to do one magic trick to prove to them that you were a god. What magic trick would you do?
Oh, my gosh. Well, being a magician, as opposed to someone who just hears the words magic trick, the scope of what I do is limited by things that actually exist rather than by having actual powers. So I would hope that there would be a piece of fruit on the island, and I would have a signed rock or trinket or something that belonged to the tribal elder vanish and reappear inside that piece of fruit, hoping that I would not be on the business end of any of those spears. And having worked cruise ships before, the possibility of this happening seems real to me.
So. Oh, man. It would be like Castaway 2 starring Bruce Gold. I love it. You know, and so, hey, rock the coconut.
Now, everyone, take your spears and turn the pointy end and stick it in the ground and watch as this handkerchief goes right through it. Oh my gosh.
Get creative. Well, I tell you what, Bruce, I actually love that. I love that. There you go. Before we get out of here, Bruce, one more time, you did mention your show, you mentioned the website. Any other things you would like to plug, like where's Bruce Gold going to be? Where can people find you?
Sure. I'm not sure exactly when this episode will air, but I'll just tell people at the end of September 2021, I'm going to be at Hollywood's famous Magic Castle. And then a week later, I'm going to be in Erie, Pennsylvania at a phenomenal magic club called Keller's. And the gentleman, Bobby Borgia, who put this club together, is a renowned magician and creator of magic and productions himself. And he's created multiple shows for Carnival Cruise Lines, as well as having been a performer for them. And he put his whole heart and his love into this venue. And I cannot wait to do it. It's a Friday and a Saturday in October. Go to their website, Keller's in Erie, Pennsylvania, magic venue. Do the Google machine and find out exactly where. Don't go to my website. It's 20 years old. I say that because if you're going to look me up, go to Facebook and look me up, Bruce Gold on Facebook, and you'll find I have a page for my television show. I have one for Engage, Pro Tips for Performers and Presenters. And then I have one for myself, Bruce Gold. So those are the three main pages, and I post to those, and it's a good way to drop me a Facebook message and get in touch with me through those. My main page has all of the venues that I perform at upcoming, usually a week or two in advance. I'll put a little, banner or, post, social post up about that. And if anybody wants to email me, it's my name, brucegold@me.com. That's BRUCEGOLD at ME.com.
All right. I love it. And you know what? I do want to say that is a fantastic magic comedy club up there in Erie. I've seen that. That looks a real beautiful place. Well, I tell you what, Bruce, this was fun. Absolutely a blast. Some superior advice in this episode. Whether you're a performer or not, even if you're a presenter or a speaker, these are some fantastic, techniques people can, pick up. Thank you so much for sharing that, Bruce. This has been a blast. Thank you for coming on the Abracadam.
Hey, my pleasure, Danny. It was a lot of fun. And I'm going to go take a Tylenol now and try to forget about that meeting planner. So.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode with Bruce Gold. I know I did. Fantastic advice. Fantastic. I mean, trust that you're enough. I mean, you don't even have to be an entertainer to take that advice and apply it somewhere in your life. I think that was that was awesome. If you want to hear some more great advice, be sure to check out Bruce on Facebook at his page, Engage Pro Tips for Performers and Presenters. And be sure to check out the Bruce Gold Show on Facebook. I know I am, because that sounds like a blast. If you guys have not done so yet, be sure to follow and subscribe to the Abracadam podcast wherever it is you listen to your podcasts. And like always, Abracadamits, thank you for listening.
That's awesome. Let's rock and roll!
Abracadam. bucket, my kid's birthday party?